I'm Michael Wilson from the University of Texas at Dallas. We have three quite interesting papers today. Our first presenter will be Elizabeth Everton. Liz got her PhD from UCLA in 2011?
Yeah.
2011-ish. And is now now teaching in Concordia University in St. Paul. She sort of is known to this organization because she was the recipient of the Millstone Research Fellowship in 2014. She has published four articles, three of them close to my own heart because they're on visual culture, one in French Historical Studies, another in the edited volume Revising Dreyfus, Art and Law, and the third in René Lalique, Enchanted by Glass. Liz is currently working on a manuscript entitled National Heroines, Women and the Radical Right During the Dreyfus Affair. Today, she's going to give us a paper called Heroines for the End of the World, Women, Physical Courage, and Martial Heroism During the Dreyfus Affair. Liz.
Though, of course, not always military prowess. What then makes a heroine? Excluded from formal military service, women found heroism frequently in self-sacrifice. Even as turn-of-the-century mass culture popularized stories of female heroes who displayed physical courage, women in general did not cross the divide between brave heroes and martial ones. That is, the divide between the willingness to give one's life and the willingness to take a life. During the Dreyfus Affair, however, as Dreyfusards challenged ideals of male military heroism, anti-Dreyfusards made heroines out of violent women. Now, lionizing armed women posed problems. 1,000 newspaper stories of hysterical women shooting, stabbing, or throwing acid argued that women, even if they could remain calm in the face of their own death, could not contemplate taking a life without losing their minds. To reconcile Joan of Arc and the wretched female protagonists of the Faits Divers was no easy task, but it was one that anti-Dreyfusards attempted repeatedly by representing as paragons women who engaged in justifiable violence in response to their own and to the nation's victimization. Now, martial heroines, of course, were not unknown in the 1890s. As Venita Dada notes, Joan of Arc was wildly popular in this time, particularly among the nationalist, anti-Semitic, and conservative groups that coalesced around anti-Dreyfusism. The Ligue des Patriotes, the formerly Boulangist League, revived as anti-Dreyfusard in 1898, gathered for public demonstrations around the statue of Joan of Arc in Paris, and Catholic anti-Dreyfusard groups such as the Union Nationale made Joan's May feast day into a political event. The militant Marianne, red-capped and ferocious, also appeared in imagery across the political spectrum in this time, though she was a problematic figure even for Republican nationalists. Nevertheless, she appeared to rally anti-Dreyfusard troops in newspapers such as the nationalist La Patrie and the anti-Semitic Montjuïc. But most writers and artists of the 1890s stopped short of representing Joan or Marianne in the commission of a violent act, which makes the anti-Dreyfusard press's recurring vision of a heroic, murderous woman throughout 1898 all the more perplexing. So the violent heroine appeared at least three times in anti-Dreyfusard popular culture in the second half of 1898, arguably the height of the Dreyfus Affair. The first time was in fiction and then twice more in press accounts of real women's action. With each recurrence, steps were taken to buff away the heroine's problematic elements, so that the violence committed by the last heroine, Berthe Henry, was largely symbolic. But even then, violence remained a crucial element of her heroism in discourse, if not in deed. Though she did not actually commit a violent act, her reported words and public persona allowed her supporters and encouraged her supporters to imagine it. The key to the puzzle lies not in the violence itself, but in its context, which is grave danger to both the family and the nation. These women's violence in this way was both reactive and contingent, which allowed it to be figured as heroic rather than deviant. Okay, the violent anti-Dreyfusard heroine made her first extended appearance in Fergus, a play staged in the summer of 1898. Fergus was a roman à clé staging the anti-Dreyfusard version of the Dreyfus Affair, in which the Alsatian cosmopolitan, but interestingly not identified as Jewish, Henri Fergus, urged on by the nefarious Baron Kekler and the femme fatale Elsa von Schwalbach, gleefully sells out his adoptive country on the promise of power, money, and love. In so doing, he betrays not only France, but his loyal wife, Louise. Henri Fergus, like Dreyfus, is captured, convicted, and exiled, and over 3 years, his wife, brother, and a band of supporters try to exculpate him. So when this came out in mid-1898, this was a really transparent vision of the anti-Dreyfusard narrative of the affair. Of course, for the denouement, they had run out of story at this point, so they just kind of made some stuff up. Henri, whose greed and ambition have been turned into open hatred of France by 3 years of suffering on Devil's Island, bursts back on stage only to be shot by Louise. He dies calling for vengeance upon France. The police rush in and arrest Elsa, the Baron, and the Fergusards, but not Louise. She is not arrested. And the audience is informed that the honor of the army and nation has been restored. So what were anti-Dreyfusard audiences to make of Louise Fergus? Transparently a fantasy version of Lucy Dreyfus, so much so that the character was actually referred to as Lucy by at least one of the reviews of the play, she is nonetheless the unquestioned heroine of the piece, both in her extreme devotion to her family and her country, and ultimately in her final fatal act. In an early scene, Louise proclaims herself Chauvine and admits to her husband that she fell in love with him because he was a soldier. And as such, he represented the incarnation of her beliefs and dreams because he was, at least as she thought, working to defend her beloved patrie from foreign threats. With her dreams of a happy home and happy homeland shattered by her husband's triple betrayal of herself, her family, and the nation, Louise can do nothing but exact her own justice. "The law of the land spared your life," she cries before shooting, "but my justice is harsher." And in the play's original version, which you can find in the archives of the censor, Louise's final statement is actually even more on the nose. This land's justice spared your life, but mine is harsher and more just." So Louise is driven to her violent act by extraordinary circumstances. Her husband poses a severe threat to national security, one that both the law and the army are powerless to stop. The end of the play draws a clear line between Louise's execution of Henri, the restoration of military prestige, and the prevention of war with Germany. But Louise's act also has more personal ramifications. Reputation is a recurring note throughout Fergus. Louise's good reputation, brother Max's compromised reputation, and Elsa's very bad reputation. Henri's return and his confession in the final act of the play blackens not only his reputation but that of his family, including Louise and their young son. When confronting her husband, Louise claims to be dying of shame at this confession. Later, she accuses him of having left nothing to his son but a dishonored name. Her violent act is thus a form of restorative justice for the family and for the nation. And as such, it becomes symbolically male. Think of it as a duel or an execution or even a killing on the battlefield. Three months after Fergus's debut, the anti-Dreyfusard press exploded with the news of another woman who had taken justice into her own hands. On September 23, 1898, Valentine Pommier, the wife of Breton deputy Charles Pommier, shot the associate editor of the Dreyfusard newspaper La Lanterne, which had just published a scurrilous article about her. Although the man she shot actually had nothing to do with the offending article, she did not regret her act, reportedly telling the police that she felt it was necessary to get justice by herself, especially given that she had a daughter of marriageable age. While the article itself had nothing to do with the Dreyfus affair, it was actually a little insinuation about both Charles Pommier and Valentine Pommier's sexual fidelity, and Charles himself was only tepidly anti-Dreyfusard. The anti-Dreyfusard press was quick to seize on it and interpret the incident as a product of the affair, which had reached a new crest following the early September suicide of Colonel Joseph Henri. Like that of Louise Fergus, Valentine Pommier's attack was imagined as the product of circumstances, of the Dreyfus affair, and of the loss of family honor, which was, on an individual level, just as damaging as the Dreyfus affair was for the nation. With her husband out of town, and therefore unable to expunge the insult to the family name through the customary means of the duel, Valentine Palmier needed to act, and act fast. At the time of both the crime and her December trial, the anti-Dreyfusard press repeatedly drew connections between Valentine's act and the duel her husband should have fought after the article's publication. In this construction, her violent action was not aberrant, but heroic. It was the act of a courageous woman in an impossible situation. According to Le Gaulois, Madame Palmier has given us an example that should be lauded and followed. Again, for both Louise Fergus and Valentine Palmier, the personal and political were inextricably linked. Louise's family crisis was part and parcel of the national crisis created by her husband, and Valentine's predicament stemmed from the Dreyfus affair. And indeed, Le Petit Journal and La Libre Parole, both strongly anti-Dreyfusard newspapers, took this connection between the Palmier and the Dreyfus affairs a step further, arguing that not only the former was not only an unfortunate consequence of the latter, but really its natural end, and that more blood would be shed. However, perhaps the real bloodshed in the Palmier affair soured anti-Dreyfusards on the actually violent heroine, and certainly it soured them on Valentine Palmier, the more they thought about her. By the time she was tried and acquitted in late December, a new heroine had emerged to take her place, one whose violence remained somewhat safely, abstract and contained. Among anti-Dreyfusard women, Berthe Henry occupied pride of place, not only for her husband's role in the Dreyfus affair, but for her careful management of his legacy and her own celebrity. Whereas Valentine Palmier's actions, if initially figured as heroic, proved in retrospect unsettlingly messy, Berthe Henry's were careful, cautious, though arguably as dangerous. The widow of Joseph Henry, dead by his own hand after the revelation of his forgeries smashed the case against Dreyfus, Berthe too sought to get justice for herself. Her means were more pacific, the law courts, not the revolver, allowing her to retain an air of respectability and pleasing feminine vulnerability that undoubtedly contributed to her more durable appeal in anti-Dreyfusard circles. Even so, her action was figured in interviews and commentary as of a piece with those of her more bloodthirsty predecessors. If Berthe Henry forswore personal violence, it was not for lack of consideration. Berthe Henry's entry into the public eye took place following her husband's suicide on September 1, 1898. The anti-Dreyfusard press depicted her throughout the following week as almost ostentatiously vulnerable in her extreme grief, though her actions immediately before and after her husband's death show her to have been both tough and capable. Following Joseph's burial in his hometown of Pogny in the Marne, Berthe stayed out of Paris for several months. In the meantime, the anti-Dreyfusard machine spun her husband's forgeries from something that they had initially called odious and stupid into a heroic and even honest act. In response, Dreyfusard historian and politician Joseph Renac suggested in Le Siècle that Henri was not just a forger but a traitor, that he had colluded with Ferdinand Esterhazy and sold secrets to Germany. Berthe struck back in early December 1898, writing two cease and desist letters to Renac, then publicly announcing her intent to sue him for defamation, which she did in February 1899. Berthe Henry's act was the impetus for the high water mark of anti-Dreyfusism. This is, of course, the Henry subscription, which was the mammoth drive in which 20,000 anti-Dreyfusard contributors gave over 130,000 francs to pay the widow's legal bills. Berthe Henry's role in this subscription is often overlooked or minimized, but the fact is that at the time she was very much foregrounded in writing about the event. More striking is the complexity of her public persona at this time, in which victimhood and violence are tightly intertwined. In the article that initiated the subscription, written by the feminist novelist Marie-Anne de Beauvais and published on December 13 in La Libre Parole, Berthe Henry is described as brave, determined, and dangerous. Any weakness lies in her lack of money, not in her lack of will. This characterization was not invented by Beauvais. It actually reflected attitudes prevalent in the anti-Dreyfusard media at the time. What Beauvais did do was to make the implicit explicit, slipping in her article from declarations of Berthe Henry's moral courage to speculations about her physical courage and her capacity for violence. The centerpiece of the article is a statement supposedly made by the widow herself. Quote, "If I were alone in the world, I wouldn't need anyone to get justice for me. But I have my child, who has nobody but me, and even to avenge his father, I cannot risk prison, which would separate me from him." This statement was reprinted by most of the Annie Dreyfusard press the next day. Fewer than 3 months after Valentine Palmier's attack on a Dreyfusard journalist for a lesser insult than Renac's, this should be read as an unmistakable threat of violence. Later articles underline the connection between Valentine Palmier's vigilantism and Bertrand Rey's legal action. Of course, the law was the better option, but if the law could not get justice, tant pis. Or, as Maurice Barrès mused at the conclusion of the subscription about those who opposed it, would they have preferred that Madame Henri shoot Joseph Renac down like a dog? We ensured a legal outcome to a drama that would have become bloody. So yet again, we see a concatenation of personal and political circumstances leading to the execution of a violent act by a determined woman in desperate straits. The difference, fortunately for Renac, is that Bertrand Rey's violence remained abstract. It's a rhetorical and symbolic. All three women demonstrated, in the eyes of their supporters, courage, force, and decisiveness. But in Bertrand Rey's case, these qualities were expressed in more appropriate channels for a woman. And this qualifier is of the utmost importance. What Valentine Palmier did and what Bertrand Rey threatened to do would have been viewed as acceptable if carried out by Charles Palmier or Joseph Henri, if they had been there. But of course they weren't. So, what makes a heroine? In the case of Louise Fergus, Valentine Palmier, and Bertrand Rey, the answer seems to be circumstance, specifically the intermingling of personal and national crisis. In all three cases, women found themselves facing a dire threat to their families with no male protector. To neutralize this threat, they were compelled to take matters into their own hands. If they were violent, it was because, at the turn of the century, violence was used to resolve matters of honor such as these. I would suggest, though, that their willingness to assume male roles was not what made them heroines, but rather the context in which they did so, the national crisis of the Dreyfus affair. In this context, their violent acts assumed an epic proportion, so they ceased to be faits divers, which, you know, this happened with some, not frequently, but not infrequently either, and suddenly they became front-page news. For many anti-Dreyfusards, the Dreyfus affair represented nothing short of a disaster, one with the potential to bring the country to its knees and deliver it to its enemies. The play Fergus intimates that if not stopped, Henri Fergus and his cronies would not only bring war with Germany, but, as happened 27 years before, Germany would win. Regarded in this light, these violent heroines do not so much recall Marianne or Joan of Arc as the heroines of previous wars, particularly the Franco-Prussian War, as they were anthologized in books published throughout the 1870s, 1880s, and 1890s. In these works, as Margaret Darrow shows, women were presented as engaging not only in what she calls patriotic domesticity, but also in acts of violence. She writes that when France was in danger, the active defense by all her children was required, women as well as men. And indeed, we see this in books published at this time. In Jeanne France's La Femme Française Pendant la Guerre, published in 1887 and about the Franco-Prussian War, 3 out of the 12 stories feature women taking on formal military duties in place of absent husbands or male relatives. And several additional stories indicate women, and one little girl, actually, committing acts of violence against German soldiers. Ludovic Jablonski, in his 1894 work, Les Femmes Françaises à la Guerre, asked, "Why would we leave in obscurity the heroines and valiant women who did not fear to march on the enemy, to fight and die in the shadow of the national flag?" Both France and Jablonski, while acknowledging women's military heroism, present it as the product of, in Jablonski's words, necessity or devotion, with women defending their home or taking the place of absent men. Their actions are bounded by circumstance, making their violence safe. It's flagged as atypical, outside of the realm of ordinary life, and thus lacking the power to disrupt. And indeed, moreover, after committing their violent acts, the women in these books disappear back into the anonymity of daily life, if they're not actually killed in the process of committing violence. Yeah. This raises the question, can violence ever be truly safe? particularly female violence, at a time when violence of this kind was so very clearly coded male. Without a doubt, Bertrand Rive's symbolic and rhetorical violence was far preferable to Valentine Pommier's actual violence, particularly after Charles Pommier returned to Paris and fought a duel that made Valentine's act needless. Madame Henri's suit in December pushed Madame Pommier's trial to the back pages of the newspaper along with the faits divers. But even Bertrand Rive's heroism was circumscribed. She was not intended to be a real flesh and blood hero. For example, though she attended numerous political meetings, she did so as an anonymous member of an audience, not as a featured guest. And when an officer of the Ligue des Patriotes brought her as his guest to an event, his supporters advised him to refrain in the future from publicly displaying that unhappy woman. Having done her duty to the family and nation, it was more seemly for her to simply fade away, like the heroines of 1870. Louise Fergus, of course, did fade away. Her story ends. It ends with the end of the play, for which there really can be no sequel. But Valentine Pommier and Bertrand Rive did not. Their heroic stories have a notable second act. Both women were actually awarded the Legion of Honor in 1921 for their actions during the First World War, during which they were both nurses. So again, it seems circumstances called them into heroism, though this time to preserve life rather than to take it. Thank you.